Please note that the opinions and perspectives shared on the Real Pharma podcast by Nari O and Ian Wendt are their own. These views do not represent the positions, strategies, or opinions of their employers or any other organizations with which they may be affiliated. Now on with the show.
Ethnobotany is the study of how people use plants for food, shelter, medicine, art, ritual around the world. And ethnobotanists generally are people that have some background in anthropology, botany, chemistry, ecology, some bit of diplomacy and linguistic abilities to be able to do what they do. If we think of conventional pharmaceutical research in the past 50 years using combinatorial chemistry, molecular biology, high throughput screening, this would be somewhat the opposite, where you're looking at how people use plants for medicine over the last, as you said, many thousands of years, and to see if you can find leads from those plants for new novel therapeutics.
This is Real Pharma, your podcast for real conversations with pharma pathfinders. In every episode, you will hear from an industry insider who has a story to share that goes beyond the headlines. No spin, no sacred cows, no hidden agendas, just stories and the people behind them. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Nari O and Ian Wendt.
Welcome, everyone, to today's episode of the Real Pharma Podcast. I'm your host, Ian Wendt, joined, as always, by the effulgent Dr. Nari O. Today, we're excited to chat with Dr. Stephen King, a leader in the field of ethnobotanical research and sustainable pharmaceutical supply. Dr. King is currently the Chief of Sustainable Supply, Ethnobotanical Research, and IP Officer at Jaguar Health, where his pioneering work has set the standard for the integration of traditional botanical knowledge with modern pharmaceutical processes. Dr. King's career spans over four decades, during which he dedicated himself to the sustainable harvest and management of the miraculous Croton licklary tree, also known as the dragon's blood tree, found in the Amazon rainforest. Steve's efforts have been crucial in developing crofelemer from this tree into an innovative plant-based prescription medication, which is now an FDA-approved drug. Outside of his work at Jaguar Health, Dr. King actively contributes to the broader scientific and conservation communities. Notably, he is a member of the board of directors for the Healing Forest Conservatory, and his research has been recognized by the International Natural Products and Conservation Community for its impact on global health and biodiversity conservation. Dr. King's unique research and collaborations with local and indigenous communities in various regions, including the Amazon and Andean countries, emphasizes a bioculturally diverse approach to pharmaceutical development. His work exemplifies the powerful synergy between local knowledge and modern science, bringing forward solutions that respect both cultural heritage and innovative pharmaceutical science. It's an honor to have Dr. King join us today to share his insights on how integrating ethnomedical practices with pharmaceutical innovation can lead to sustainable and impactful health solutions globally. Welcome, Dr. King.
Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us today and really excited that you're making some time for us to discuss the fascinating topic. And I do want to, in full disclosure, acknowledge that Dr. Steve King and I both work at Jaguar Health. But the story that we're going to get into today is a big reason why I joined the organization a handful of years ago. Dr. King's history with the organization goes back decades. There's a lot of what we're going to talk about today that I don't even know. So I'm really anxious and looking forward to getting the full picture during this discussion.
Steve, I'm very excited that you're here on the show today. And there are really two aspects to what we're going to cover in this episode. And one is the medical, clinical aspect of the ethnobotanical research that you've been involved in for so many years. And the other is more the surround sound of how you've managed to also take into account other aspects of what the impact is of the research that you've done on communities that are involved in the ethno-diverse research or the knowledge that they have accumulated over many, many years, not just decades, but hundreds and thousands of years. So maybe we can start with the first aspect, which is, can you explain what ethnobotanical research really means and how it differs, but also complements conventional pharmaceutical research?
Yes, it'll be a pleasure to do that. And again, thank you for having me. I do want to mention that there is a large component of bioethics to this whole conversation. I listened to one of your podcasts with a bioethicist, and as I listened to it, I thought, wow, there's some overlaps here, so that'll be kind of fun. Yes, ethnobotany is the study of how people use plants for food, shelter, medicine, art, ritual around the world. And ethnobotanists generally are people that have some background in anthropology, botany, chemistry, ecology, some bit of diplomacy and linguistic abilities to be able to do what they do. The question about the conventional pharmaceutical research, if we think of conventional pharmaceutical research in the past 50 years, using combinatorial chemistry, molecular biology, high throughput screening, this would be somewhat the opposite, where you're looking at the, how people use plants for medicine over the last, as you said, many thousands of years, and to see if you can find leaves from those plants for new novel therapeutics. And I should add that 80% of the world's planets use plants as a source of medicine on a daily basis. So whether they come to us as pharmaceuticals or as plant medicines, they are a big part of the human health story.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's sometimes we hear a term and we're not quite sure exactly what that might mean. I know I felt that way when I joined the organization. It sounded interesting, but I didn't know a whole lot about it. The question that comes to mind for me is, how did you find yourself pursuing that area professionally? I assume, you know, obviously it started in your academic journey, translated itself into this professional journey you've been on for decades now. But I would suspect that's fairly atypical. I don't know any ethnobotanists in the pharmaceutical world, and I've been at this quite a while.
Yeah. So my, not to get into too much detail, but my journey started out of personal fascination at the age of 13, reading a book about the Amazon, believe it or not. I then ended up spending about a month living with an indigenous group briefly, actually a little less than a month in high school. It's a long story how that happened. And then I ended up spending 9 months living with a tribe on the Colombian-Ecuadorian border in the remote part of the Peruvian Amazon, studying their diet and medicinal plants. That was all before I knew a great deal about the field of ethnobotany. That might sound funny, but then I did come back and met some of the leading experts in this country, Dr. Schultes at Harvard and Tim Plowman at the Field Museum, who basically opened the doors to me of what is ethnobotany. So it came from a personal fascination from an early age that I studied how people use plants for medicine.
Well, shed a little light on that for us, because I think that might be interesting to learn. So how does a young person, sounds like a lot of this maybe started before you even entered your kind of college years, and you end up camping out with an indigenous tribe and learning how they take care of their sick.
Yeah, to make it a short version, I became acquainted with a Jesuit priest missionary who was working with indigenous people in the northern Peruvian Amazon. They had hired a scientist to do a study on the diet and medicinal plants of this particular group, the Angoteres Sequoia Indians. That person basically failed and sort of disappeared on them. And I had met this Jesuit priest previously, and he asked if I wanted to, as an internship, come spend 9 months and replace that person. So they had the infrastructure. I got sent up to this remote village of about 35 indigenous people and lived with them for 9 months and worked with them, went in the field with them, collected with them, and became part of their daily life while I documented as best I could their diet and medicinal plants. And that is, as they would say, I was hooked. It was an amazing formative experience in my life. I've been back since to that particular village and many, many other villages. So that's sort of how I got there.
And how old were you when this happened, this opportunity?
21 for the 9 month period and about 17 the first time.
Did you speak the language at that time? Did you have to kind of figure things out as you went along?
I spoke not really great Spanish, but they spoke Sequoia and not a lot of Spanish. So there was not a lot of deep conversations. A lot of it was observation and participation. Some of them definitely spoke more than enough Spanish, but no, I was by no means fluent in their language, and even my Spanish wasn't great at the time.
Wow.
And then what did you study in college or maybe beyond college?
I did my bachelor's in human ecology at the College of the Atlantic, which is only gives one degree, and that's the study of the interrelationship of people and their environment and their society. And then I did my PhD at the Institute of Economic Botany in the New York Botanical Garden, which was a newly formed program, which had a focus on looking at how people use plants to support and sustain themselves and how they interface with the global economy and the environment. In that particular program, I focused on ethnobotany, working with some of the leading ethnobotanists in this country.
That's really fascinating. And you mentioned earlier on, there was always a very holistic aspect, I think, to what you did. So it's not just we're looking at plants that are being used to treat patients or treat people who are not feeling well, but it goes way beyond that. It's the medical aspect, the social aspect, there's linguistics, you threw that in there as well, because obviously if you don't speak the language, you can't communicate and a lot gets lost. How did that translate into the early work that you did with the indigenous peoples?
Some of them spoke Spanish. One had been in the army, so it wasn't exactly just a little blonde-haired guy standing around looking confused. There was conversations. Absolutely, I was looking at their diet, what they actually weighed what people ate, which was a bit annoying at times to the participants, and I would document that on a regular basis. This was what I was basically hired to do. Yes, it is more of a holistic look at how people live, survive, and thrive in their tropical environments. And some of the work I did after that before getting in the pharma was working for the Nature Conservancy, looking at issues of conservation and tropical forests.
You mentioned this already. I think there is a significant ethical component here that often can come into play. Certainly as we start thinking about, you know, the development of and commercialization of medications here in the United States that would be sold by a for-profit company, and what are the ethical implications of that? And the episode you were referring to is when we talked to Dr. Arthur Kaplan, who's a noted bioethicist out of NYU. It's interesting looking at your first interactions there. It was mostly observational. How do you build trust in those communities? Why do they think you're there? And how do you build that trust? And then ultimately, maybe you can talk about the transition of your role in terms of not just observing, maybe in terms of conservation, but also looking for value, commercial value, let's say, in some of the ways that they were treating their sick and some of the indigenous knowledge that existed among these groups.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. So there was a little more than observation. I did collect the actual medicinal plants that they were utilizing. I did bring back voucher herbarium specimens, that which are used to document such plants. Those were provided to museums in the United States, and I did publish on that. That was the beginning of a documentation of the ethnobotanical use of plants for healing among this particular group. The answer about how you make relationships is, first and foremost, you have to obviously describe who you are, what you're doing, why you're there. And then if you move forward to more of the looking at plants as sources of new pharmaceuticals, it would require prior informed consent, actually discussing, communicating well in advance who you are, what you're going to do. In our case, we put in place short, medium, and long-term benefit sharing with the communities and the countries that we worked in. That would include some percentage of the research budget going directly to the community that we're working with. That would be arranged, discussed in advance of ever doing anything in the community, where the community would determine what they would like to apply such resources towards. Those could be and were such things as providing clean water pipes, actually purchasing them and getting them transported to a remote part of Borneo where the community lives, providing resources to a community in Lake Victoria outside of Kampala, Uganda, where a boat could be used to deliver people quickly to medical facilities and emergencies. These are things that the community would just sit down and discuss amongst themselves. If we are going to receive these resources, what would we do with them? We would never provide, say, $10,000, $15,000 to an individual to go buy a Mercedes or something like that. So it would be a long-term process of dialogue and discussion and asking permission. And at times they'd say, no, we're not interested, which is as important as those that said that they were interested. Then it would continue and go on as we get to talk about the long-term sustainable harvest of our crofelemer product. It became an ongoing long-term relationship with numerous communities.
So let's take the crofelemer example, and maybe you can walk us through what happened there and what is happening. You have spent a lot of your time on this one tree that is actually really very interesting tree when you look at the properties. It's called the Croton Lechleri tree or a dragon's blood tree. Can you talk a little bit about this tree and what makes it so special?
Sure. I might back up. And the way we came upon looking at that particular tree was we worked with a scientific strategy team. These were chemists, physicians, pharmacologists, botanists, ethnobotanists, who sat around in a room, believe it or not, at a facility in Harvard and discussed the lead candidates that they had all researched, myself included, all around the world. We came out with the top 10 that looked most interesting. Among those was Croton lechleri, because it is widespread and well-known among multiple cultures and countries in the Amazon basin. What makes this tree special is it's part of the ethnomedicine of literally dozens of indigenous peoples, hundreds of thousands of peoples, used for treating many diseases, including GI distress, diarrhea, ulcers, and related, also used topically as a wound healing agent. What makes it special is that it seems to work, and that's the foundation of this entire endeavor, is looking at things that people have used for thousands of years to manage their health. So it's a pre-screening, if you will. Obviously, it's going to be safe, not going to take it if it doesn't, and they're not going to keep using it if it doesn't work. add the fact that this tree is a pioneer species. It's widespread, grows rather quickly, about 1 foot a month for the first 2 years, 24 feet in 2 years. So the ecology and the biology of the species lent itself very well to being looked at as a potential drug. Then we learned that the compound of interest, crofelemer, can't be made synthetically. It has 35 chiral centers. Therefore, we were interdependent with the people who grow, harvest, and reforest this tree, which is a part of their cultural ecology, a part of their traditional medicine. That is their medicine chest. When somebody has problems, they go out and use a plant to manage their health. So it was a combination of its biology, its ecology, its ethnomedical uses, and then, of course, that it started showing promise in phase one, phase two, and all the other milestones of developing a drug.
And out of those top 10 candidates, can you just disclose to our audience how many of those made it past that initial screening?
Of the top 10, we did pursue three or four others that did not actually get into phase one clinical trials, but for which we did do preclinical work. So it's a small percentage, in fact, of all those that we looked at, including about 2,600 other plants that we collected in 25 countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Croton lechleri, that tree, that drug, is the one that has made it to the market.
Wow. Okay. So the odds are maybe a little bit better than traditional drug development when you start in a lab and you do a synthetic drug discovery, but this was a feat.
Yes, although I'd say they're a lot better than a little bit better if you look at the expense associated. I think, I don't know what the latest numbers are for $1 billion, $500 million, you pick your number. We certainly spent quite a bit less than that. And there are more drugs have come onto the market since then. I'd say it's a little better than a little bit better because of what the pharma industry spends billions and billions on various programs, which yield, I don't think, so many new molecular entities.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think the latest number is something like all in, maybe $1 billion is spent for every new drug that makes it to market. Whatever the actual number is, it's large. And it does reflect a tremendous amount of research and screening thousands or potentially tens of thousands of compounds to find the one that works. And it does sound like maybe the odds are slightly better in terms of your experience. So just a couple things I wanted to go maybe a layer deeper on. And I like that you called out the idea that the Croton lechleri tree is not old growth rainforest that's being harvested, right? These are very fast growing trees and they grow in their backyard or on the side of the road. But it is significant, as has been pointed out, that you found this tree because it has these remarkable properties. I want to talk about that. But it's how you went about it as well. I think that's equally as important because doing it in a sustainable, ethical way is such a big part of the story. It's one thing just to go in and find some trees and harvest them and take the material that you need. But that's not exactly what's been done here. It's been done, you know, much more thoughtfully. And can you just talk about that in a little more detail? Not only what it meant to, let's say, the manufacturer, but what it meant to those local communities and the people that work in those communities?
Absolutely. I should also mention that the way we learned about it, it wasn't the smart guy you're talking to. It was the indigenous people taught us about how they use it. And that is all that we do and all that we did do. They are the ones who discovered it, and they are the ones that had the medical expertise that they taught to us. We're proud and happy that we've been able to work directly with over 19 different indigenous culture groups in more than 30 locations in Peru alone, where individuals, women, men, are partners in harvesting this material. Our colleagues go directly to the communities. They receive direct payment for their work. They decide if they wish to work or not on harvesting and reforesting this tree that they're very familiar with as part of their environment. It provides benefits for the communities, for the families. They need food, clothing, and medicine just like we do. So there's a direct benefit to those communities and people. There's another bigger picture to all this as well, that, as you know, there's tremendous deforestation going on throughout the tropical regions of the world. At the same time, there are the loss of languages and indigenous knowledge of elders and healers as communities become less enamored of that in some cases. One of the approaches that's being put forward to help conserve, for instance, the Amazon is to find bioeconomy resources, things that can be harvested sustainably other than timber or plant a clearing forest for soybean. So any and all products that can be part of the bioeconomy provide income to local communities to help them sustain and use their forest in a fashion that can go on forever is being deemed one of the possible and potential positive, powerful solutions to finding ways to conserve tropical forest ecosystems. And by the way, also to help conserve the cultural diversity, those languages, the knowledge, because when the youth see people becoming excited about plants that are part of commerce and part of healing, it helps create more an interest among young people in those communities that this is an important part of the future. So there's more and more programs not being promoted by gringos or foreigners, but by local communities to transmit and transfer that knowledge from elders to youth, as well as to create community gardens and tropical forest medicinal gardens. These are very positive and exciting things that are part of this process that we're only a small piece of.
Are there other companies that are either doing this currently or have done this, that have followed this model? I mean, how unique is what you're describing to the industry? Because I can't think of any other examples. I'd love to learn if there are other folks finding success in the same way. I worry maybe not enough or viewing this as a viable option.
Great question. The short answer is in the pharma sector, I'm not that familiar with many people doing this. Although I am going to segue later a little bit into the big focus on psychedelic and psychoactive plants and the massive boom in research in that area. In that sector, you're seeing more companies. Many are more looking at synthetics and trying to sort of leverage that powerful constituents of those plants for mental health diseases. So no, other than that sector, which is kind of booming as more laboratory-based, not very many. The difference is that there are companies that sell phytomedicines, which are certainly not pharmaceuticals. They're doing some of this sort of work, working with communities, working with sustainability, putting those products on the market and returning benefits, but not quite in the scale that we're doing, but it's still positive and important.
That brings me to another question. Obviously, you're relying on indigenous knowledge about the Croton lechleri tree and the other plants that you were evaluating. It's the same thing. Where does intellectual property come into play here? How is that handled?
That's one of the topics of this conference that I attended this weekend. Obviously, in our pharmaceutical industry, intellectual property is extremely important for the obviously protection and development. There's a tremendous amount of concern by indigenous elders, women, and so on about the exploitation and use of that knowledge, whether you pay them for it or not. In the case of sacred plants, like those that are being looked at, like iboga or mushrooms or ayahuasca, they are very concerned about the whole concept of just selling them, period, much less with intellectual property. Having said that, there are also norms and guidelines put in place by the Convention on Biological Diversity, or something called the Nagoya Protocol. It was approved in 2014 as part of the Convention on Biological Diversity, which stipulates that there has to be a fair and equitable development and benefit sharing associated with any products like this, including things that are patented. We took an approach from the beginning, 20, 30 years ago, of doing short, medium, and long-term benefit sharing, like we talked about previously. So indigenous groups often look at time not in 20-year chunks, but in 200, 300-year chunks. So in some ways, a 20-year control is anathema to their viewpoint that it's supposed to be available and shared by all peoples. At the same time, 20 years isn't that long of a time period in terms of their global worldview. It's critical that there are benefits being shared. We're very fortunate in the case of our first product, this Croton lechleri-derived drug, crofelemer, that we are engaged in. Actually, we've provided about $6 million back to the country of Peru. About $4 million of that has gone directly to indigenous communities on the ground, families, people, individuals. That may not sound like a lot in the pharma sector, but to people and communities and so on, it's actually quite significant. That's sort of the intention of the entire Convention on Biological Diversity, is that there be benefit sharing and sustainable development of genetic and biological resources. So intellectual property is a huge topic of concern to the communities. And there are, at the same time, communities whom are interested in being in partnership with ethical, transparent players, because they also are interested in finding ways to get benefits from this. Now, when you switch it towards the psychedelic sacred plants like ayahuasca, iboga, peyote, mushrooms, it gets a little more difficult because there is a strong feeling that some of this should never be commercialized. Having said that, as you know, there's a massive mental health boom focusing on these things for PTSD, substance abuse, addiction. There's already one about to get approved, NMDA, for PTSD amongst vets. That's not exactly a plant of indigenous origin, that compound. But there's going to be quite a few, in my view, in the next 5 to 10 years, drugs that are going to change the mental health landscape that come directly from indigenous knowledge.
And then do you also take that into account when you set up the whole structure, or did you do that with Corvella Mayor, where you provide legal advice or you connect the indigenous people with somebody who can provide that advice so they can protect their rights?
These days, more and more, there are indigenous intellectual property lawyers. So the answer is they're rather sophisticated. They have access to a lot of information, expertise, and there are other international groups who are keen to offer them that assistance. So the answer is, in the beginning, we were very painstaking in our discussion and dialogues about what we were doing, how we were trying to do it, what the benefits might be. Let's not forget that, as we all know, a patent in and of itself is meaningless and useless unless you can develop a product that generates revenue. I mean, it has a symbolic meaning, but in terms of its practical meaning, it doesn't mean much. So we would explain that there would be a low likelihood of anything ever coming out of the research that we did, and that patents have lifespans. And ironically, I think one of the most important things is taking your time to this week. And I heard many indigenous people saying, you know, the problem with this whole boom is you guys are in a hurry. You're going too fast. You're not letting the communities have dialogues and discussions. So ironically, back in the early days, we were moving very, very, very slowly, intentionally. We were working, of course, with government authorization as well as community authorization. And we were having some difficulty with some of the one government in particular, remain nameless at the moment. And the indigenous community said to us, what's with you guys? It's taken forever. You told us you'd do this and this hasn't happened in a year. So there's that dynamic tension of, yeah, we want to be careful and slow and have transparency and make sure both parties have sort of equal or as much as possible knowledge and expertise. But then at times they're like, come on, keep it moving.
So I definitely want to get into, you mentioned some of the boom, let's say, around the psychedelics and some of the concerns and kind of considerations around that. But before we do, the other more common name, I think, for the Croton Leclerii tree is dragon's blood tree. And maybe you could describe, because I was really fascinated by this, why it has that name, and just kind of walk through the process. When we say harvest, what does that mean? Like, what are they getting out of the tree? How do they do it? What does that look like? Because I think that's really, really interesting if you were to see it.
Yeah. Not to be too much of a history geek, the name Sangre de Drago, of course, is Spanish, not an indigenous word. And the Spanish had a tree in the Canary Islands of different genus that also had a red latex. And from this tree, Sangre de Drago, dragon's blood, comes a red latex. When the Spanish came to the New World and they saw people using this tree, they said, oh, it's like our Sangre de Drago, which is a completely different tree, also used for healing wounds from sword fights and stuff. So this is also a topical red latex in this case. In the indigenous languages, it's got about 20 different names. The blood of the tree, this of the tree, but it's a Spanish name. The way it's harvested for local use is they take a machete, hit the tree, small amounts of this sap, as we are calling it, come out of the tree, and they apply that orally or topically. In commerce, because it was in commerce prior to our involvement, they would take the entire tree, lay it down, harvest it, and make circles all along the trunk of the tree and collect the latex as it drips into leaves or other containers. As I mentioned, this has been in commerce in Lima and Bogota, in other parts of Latin America. And of course, prior to the Spaniards coming, it was traded as well. So there's two ways of harvesting it, a way that's sort of my backyard way, where I take a little bit from my child who has, say, diarrhea or a cough or a wound, or a way to get larger quantities. And that would be to harvest the entire tree and take all that sap from the tree, and then leave the tree on the ground, let it degrade back into the environment, sort of like cradle to grave. Nothing leaves the forest except a little bit of liquid.
And I hope that our audience can look this up. It really looks like blood.
It does indeed.
It's disturbing. It looks like blood. It really looks like the tree's bleeding.
It does. In fact, when we would bring it into Los Angeles, the customs agents would say, uh-oh, you got to have special permits to import blood. We say, first of all, there's no such thing as dragons. Second of all, it's not blood. So yeah, you're right. It looks like blood.
Yeah. And I think if I understand correctly, you actually figured out that for your purposes, it didn't make sense to use the first method. Just like you tap a maple tree for maple syrup, you ended up realizing that you have to really take the whole tree.
That is correct.
And that led to the question of how do you find a sustainable solution, right? Because you're felling the tree.
Right. The amazing part about this is, I wish I could say we were so brilliant, but the tree is so fast growing. As I mentioned, 1 foot a month for the first 2 years. It's also super abundant. It's a pioneer. I never liked the word weed, but it is so widespread that people cut it down when they plant their gardens and all that sort of thing. Part of our program at one point was just don't cut it down. If it's in the way, leave it there. We'll buy it eventually, the material. So yes, we wanted to do it like rubber, if you've ever seen the white latex that come from rubber trees, and because it's the same plant family, the Euphorbiaceae, that would be the obvious thing to do. So we started doing that. We started doing studies, and the foundation of this is biology, ecology, and basic research to understand how it grows, where it grows, how fast it grows, and so on. We found that when you take a little bit, like a half a liter from this tree, and then you come back 6 to 7, 8, 9 months later, the tree's dying. And we're like, why is that happening? And we sent samples to the Kew Botanic Garden, to a specialist in the bark, the morphology of this bark. And what that specialist said to us was, these laticifers, that which create the latex or sap, are distinct from like the hevea or the rubber tree ones. When you cut them, they regenerate. That's why they can make the cuts, they keep coming back. In this case, when you make some cuts, except for a small amount, the tree starts to desiccate, dry out, and die. So it's a completely different morphology. And it kind of makes sense. This tree produces about 500,000 to 1 million seeds per year. It has a short lifespan. The wood is like balsa wood. It's not very dense. You can't use it for anything. So its whole modus operandi is grow fast, make lots of seeds, and then decease and go on and do it again. So the nature of the tree is what let it be sustainable, is that it grows so fast. It's so widespread. It's so well known and people know about it. Although we certainly wanted to do what you said initially, which was, oh, this will be great. But the morphology and biology of the species did not allow for that.
In the name of sustainability, though, I just wanted to point this out. For every tree that is felled, I believe the program is designed to plant two more. And I think there's something like maybe 1 million trees have been planted to date. Is that right?
Yeah, we planted about 1.2 million trees. A whole lot more than that are growing all by themselves, to put it mildly. And I should also mention, in the community context, these are cultivated in agroforestry systems, which is to say there's no monocultures, there's no one place where a bunch are growing. We're talking more than 30 locations, actually. So they interplant it with different food plants, different other plants that they grow for medicine. In fact, we don't tell them how to do it. We don't even tell them where to do it. We actually have them teach us, and they do what works for them. Fortunately, our colleagues extract and purify the API that always meets FDA regulatory guidance, but it's been quite beautiful to basically let them tell us, here's what works, rather than us say, here's a seed that we have bred for higher yield of this or that. We don't do any of that, and we never have. All the trees come from where they actually grow, so they're replanting the things that are in their environment. So it's an indigenous traditional knowledge that manages the species more than us.
And what are some of the concrete examples that you could share about how some of these benefits have come back to those communities? You mentioned some in the beginning, but for this particular tree and the communities that planted.
I was with some communities in August, a pretty remote part of the Peruvian Amazon. I got to go see all the trees that they're planting and harvesting. I got to see the men, women, families, and children that are receiving the financial benefits. And that's pretty much reality what it is. A lot of these places, they have to go quite a bit of distance to maybe sell something, to purchase things that they need, whether it be, say, shotgun shells or clothes or even books and things for school. They actually receive the financial benefit directly in their hands. There's not an intermediary who takes 30% or something like that. So the benefits are basically the same thing you want for your family, ways to sustain your family, ways to have clothes, medicine, healthcare, and education.
One other interesting aspect, I think, to the red latex that I became aware of fairly recently is it's used in so many areas addressing medicinal needs, but there's this group of artists that paint with it as well, right? And so I have some of that art.
Yeah.
I know you do. In the show notes, we'll put a link to some of the very talented artists.
Good.
That create these amazing, a lot of them are of kind of the landscape or of different animals that you might find in the jungle. It's really amazing what you can do with this latex, even beyond some of its healing properties.
It's quite a strong red pigment, and you're right, it's very durable. And in fact, one of the artists that I met, all of his paintings are made with resins and latexes and exudates from medicinal plants. That's all he uses, not just this one. So yeah, it's a cool story. It's a really cool story.
Yeah, amazing.
So Steve, you mentioned, obviously, crofelemer is FDA approved for use in this country. Are there some differences or challenges with regards to regulatory approvals that you're aware of as it comes to a plant-based drug versus a more traditional synthetic drug?
Sure. You know, this is the first oral botanical drug approved by the US FDA. That's a different classification of botanical drugs. We're obviously looking at other ones, particularly in one of our joint ventures, Magdalena Biosciences. But for the most part, in terms of preclinical, clinical, toxicology, all that, it's the same requirements as any drug. The specific differences are when you're sourcing from a plant, the FDA requires that you have a bioassay to help ensure batch-to-batch consistency. That's not a big problem. It's also actually a proprietary position. It's more than not a problem. In some ways, it's a benefit because you couldn't generically make this unless you had a similar bioassay and it's not disclosed. So it's kind of another level of protection. So batch-to-batch consistency from the harvesting is important, and that's distinct. Although in any given API manufacturing process, you obviously have to have batch-to-batch consistency. There's a little more rigorous demands of the FDA, especially in the beginning, to prove to them that you can make the same API that meets all the specifications every single time, which we do, and it's highly characterized, actually. So that's kind of the only real difference, except that there's some presumed safety if you're dosing at a similar dose as taken by humans of the active ingredient. You kind of already have an idea that this is going to be safe. Obviously, you have to prove that in the preclinical and all that.
So let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned Magdalena and kind of the moment, let's say, that psychedelics are having in general right now, and hopefully for positive reasons. There's significant unmet need in let's say, the mental health area for sure. You mentioned MDMA. That's just one example among many that are out there at various stages of development and research. So talk a little bit about that effort, just so we understand what that all means and how you screen for these particular potential assets and how you get them potentially into market.
It's worth a whole other show for sure. You might even get somebody even more knowledgeable than me because it's a boom. It's a paradigm shift in medicine. They're looking at Iboga from Ibogaine for addiction, helping manage addiction. People take that and stop having cravings for heroin sometimes within a couple of administrations. In the case of Lykos, PTSD, I heard of Afghanistan vet this weekend talking about her treatment with that substance and the benefits it provided to her. You've got clinical trials going on at UCSF and, of course, John Hopkins and in the UK looking at anxiety, depression. These all come from a plants used as sacred psychoactive psychedelic substances amongst cultures like the Mazateca in Mexico for the psilocybin mushrooms, in Gabon, Gabonese cultures and Igbo people using ibogaine as an ordeal poison for and other purposes, a rite of passage. Ayahuasca, which, as you know, is just almost astonishing the breadth that it now has in the global marketplace, not as a approved pharmaceutical, but there's quite a bit of focus looking at that for end-of-life anxiety, PTSD, possibly addiction studies. So the amount of money that's been poured in has been astonishing. The amount of academic, I think there's literally dozens of academic research centers now looking at psychedelics after the what is commonly called the pollinization effect when Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, became so popular and made into a Netflix series. So, and this is where your bioethics come in big time because a lot of these indigenous people, they are not that comfortable with the idea of commodifying a sacred plant. And that is not a simple thing. If you say that it's going to help people with illnesses and diseases, sometimes that helps because a lot of the healers have a primary goal to be healers. They don't often view it as appropriate to be part of a commodification scheme. The cat's out of the bag in terms of we're going to be seeing mental health therapeutics. Magdalena, we're more looking at a few more psychoactives, things that you could take at home that are not psychedelics per se that require therapists in a room holding your hand or looking after you. Those psychoactives also can be quite important in the realm of new therapeutics. Again, all from traditional indigenous knowledge.
Are they also similarly sourced in the same region? Are we still talking about the Amazon? Are there, because you focus a lot on the Amazon, I have to think there's the whole rest of the world where these botanical opportunities might exist.
Yeah, well, the fascinating thing is, take, for example, the psilocybin mushrooms. Those were originally, quote-unquote, discovered amongst the Mazatec, Maria Sabina, and Mexico. But, of course, you can grow them in your basement, as do many companies now who are working on them. Sustainability is a non-issue. Those can be grown cheap, fast, easy. And then move to ayahuasca. It's a vine, comes from the Amazon. It's pretty fast growing vine, but there's a huge demand outside of the pharma sector already globally, and it's having an impact on that. People are traveling to the Amazon as well as other places. Then you take something like Iboga. Iboga is a shrub, West Africa, from West Africa, not the Amazon. That's a slower growing shrub. They use the roots, and that, there you have sustainability issues in terms of if you don't make it synthetically. And many of these companies are looking at synthetics and tweaking compounds, as we know they are wont to do, to try and find a patent position. Then you take things like peyote, slow growing cactus from the Southwest desert in northern Mexico. There's a huge concern about the overutilization of that particular plant medicine for both the not yet approved world, as well as the potential, if it were to be sourced as a natural plant drug, probably it'll be a more of a synthetic. You've even got the toads, the Sonoran toads, from which they're getting certain compounds that are very, very potent, dimethyltryptamine related sorts of compounds. So yes, sustainability, not an issue with mushrooms, definitely an issue with Iboga, definitely an issue with peyote. There's geographic differences, there's ecological, the sustainability differences, and then there's the amazing chemistry, the magic of synthetic chemistry that's going on with these things at the same time.
Yeah, I have to imagine there's some challenges to find a scalable, sustainable way to harvest toads. So somebody might figure that out. Maybe that'll go synthetic, but it seems like that's fraught with challenges.
They already have a synthetic version of 5-MeO. So yes, they definitely do.
Oh, okay. Well, the toads are relieved to hear that for sure.
They definitely do. And mescaline, of course. Mescaline has been synthesized. I mean, a lot of these things will be synthesized.
Besides the mental health applications that you just outlined, Steve, are there other trends that you foresee taking off in the next 5, 10, 20, 50 years in this area?
Based on ethnobotanical or ethnomedical research, we know there's one very successful, the billion-dollar drug Epidiolex for epilepsy. That cannabis was used historically for convulsions over the last several thousand years. That plant, if that is actually extracted from a cultivar in the UK, and it's grown, you know, hard cultivated, it's not wild. So the answer to your question is, yes, I believe there are going to be others for certain. I think there might be a slight circling back to look more carefully at plants used in, say, traditional Chinese medicine, and there's a huge, you know, industry in that now, and Ayurvedic traditional medicine, of course. So I think there'll be more focus. It does kind of go cyclical. I think we're looking at a cyclical uptick for good reasons. I think also you know that this whole focus on things like psilocybin and even LSD and so on, this isn't new. This was being looked at in the 50s by researchers in Canada and the United States for alcoholism and other kinds of issues. It got suppressed based on the war on drugs, and then they got pushed away. And that includes things like coca and coca leaves. So we're sort of seeing a reevaluation of the therapeutic application of these things that were demonized for a period of time.
And certainly to your point, at least when it comes to plant-based healing properties, there seems to be a huge boom with, you know, wellness and going back to more traditional methods of addressing ailments. So I think that is definitely something that we see everywhere.
And some clients are definitely, or patients are interested in a naturally sourced compound versus a synthetic one. I mean, obviously, it's only a certain percentage of people that take pharmaceuticals care about that, and then others do.
I find it really interesting, something you just brought up, that the war on drugs, it remains to be seen some of the unintended consequences, negative consequences of that, in suppression of research and some very valuable, among some very valuable compounds that we're now learning can offer some great benefit for people. And we lost potentially decades because of that suppression of research. And now if they come to market and people benefit from them, you know, it makes you ask the question, how many people over the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years, let's say, because the war on drugs came about in the early 70s, I think was Nixon. So we've lost many people, or lost the opportunity to help many people over that time period. Hopefully we don't repeat those mistakes. I know it's ethically challenging, and maybe it was well-intentioned, but history may prove that there were some bad decisions made there.
Without a doubt, it went along with the Vietnam War, Nixon, and the suppression of what was perceived as the LSD and these things were causing some of this problem. We need to get rid of them, not based on anything scientific. As you know, Sandoz, Albert Hofmann, synthesized LSD somewhat by accident. And for a while there, it was looked at as a very promising, interesting compound for both psychiatric as well as other conditions. So I think you're right. I think we did lose time. My understanding is that in some ways, of all things, the country of Israel wasn't as suppressive, and they've made some more advances, as I understand it, certainly in the area of some cannabis research. So you're absolutely right. We lost time. But fortunately, we haven't lost the knowledge about how to use them in a traditional context. But from a scientific and medical, I completely agree. We, for political and not very rational reasons, we lost time.
Well, hopefully we can fix that. And hopefully we don't repeat those mistakes. And it's encouraging, as you said, maybe we're on an uptick now where we are having a little bit of a renaissance or a moment here where that research is taking place, investment dollars are flowing in, and that's encouraging.
Yeah. Renaissance is a good word. The indigenous people don't quite look at it that way. They kind of laugh and say, Renaissance? We've been at this for about 1,000 years, so right. Maybe you need to refigure that, gringos. But that's okay. I mean, dialogue is what it's about.
Yeah, fair enough. Good point, Steve.
So, Steve, we've really only scratched the surface of hearing from you about your incredible experience and knowledge about this topic, and it's been such an interesting conversation. And maybe we have to do a follow-up at some point and really dive into the details more. But for now, is there anything that you want to share with the audience that throughout your professional career has made an impact on you? It could be a person, could be a motto, could be an experience that probably have so many, too many for you to pick one because you already shared some of them. But is there something that has guided you on your path professionally?
Actually, there is a person who's been pivotal to myself and to hundreds of ethnobotanists and to the formation of this company, and his name is Dr. Richard Evans Schultes. He was a Harvard ethnobotanist. He lived in the Colombian Amazon for 14 years. He believed in indigenous knowledge. He was one of the early proponents of conservation and respecting indigenous rights. He trained people all over the world. He has a fascinating life trajectory. He discovered and documented thousands of plants. He was sent back to the Amazon in World War II to look for rubber sources because the Japanese had taken over the rubber plantations in Malaysia. He worked carefully on documenting that. He helped to start this company. He was a mentor to me. There's a wonderful book about his life called One River, written by Wade Davis. If this topic interests your listeners and would like to learn more about some of the fundamental early ethnobotanists, Richard Evans Schultes, extremely colorful person, a major mentor in my life to many, many people around the world, sometimes referred as the father of ethnobotany. So other than the people themselves, the indigenous people who have been so gracious to myself and to my colleagues over the years, whom I'm enormously appreciative to have had the opportunity to work with, he has been a major person in my life and in this field.
Thank you for sharing that. We'll link to the book in the show notes.
But since I'm plugging books, if somebody gets interested in ethnobotany, I have a strong plug for the book, Plants, People, and Culture, The Science of Ethnobotany, written by two of the sort of leading ethnobotanists, colleagues and friends, and part of our team.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll do that. Wonderful.
Thank you so much for your time, Steve. It was a true pleasure.
Thank you, Steve. This was a lot of fun. And even I learned a lot, even though we work together, we don't always have the time to go into this level of depth on your history, and certainly interesting and helpful for me to understand. So I'm sure our audience appreciates it.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Steve. Until next time. Bye now.
Okay. Bye.
So a really interesting and a bit of a different type of conversation with Dr. King than maybe what we usually cover on this podcast. A couple things that stood out for me. We talked a lot about the ethical considerations. I think that's a real challenge to do that right. Hopefully what Dr. King described in terms of working with indigenous communities around the Croton-Leclerc tree is a best practice example of what good looks like. I believe that it's true, and I hope more companies follow suit. And then I was really encouraged to hear that there are resources available to these communities, legal resources and folks that are protecting their IP concerns in this area. You know, I think Steve said they're more sophisticated in that area than we might expect, which is wonderful. I'm glad they have resources and expertise available to them so they can advocate for their needs and their interests in all of this. And hopefully we all benefit. It can be a win-win. And I think it's a great model moving forward.
For me, what stood out in this really fun episode, as you said, it's a little bit different from what we normally talk about, is Steve describing this very holistic, sustainable model of gaining benefit and returning benefit. And I wonder if that can be applied beyond just pharma in many other aspects as well. So it would be really interesting to see if there are other case studies where that works really well.
Yeah, I hope so. And I think that's something that we'll learn more about moving forward. And great to see that we have some great minds working on this topic and love just the conversation with Dr. King. So another fun episode, Nari. Thank you so much. And until next time.
Thank you, Ian. See you soon. Bye.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us at realpharma.co for more valuable resources. Real Pharma is brought to you by Black Canyon Ventures.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Real Pharma. We hope our dose of pharmaceutical discourse has left you in good spirits and has increased your titers of knowledge.
Absolutely. If you found today's pill-packed adventure as stimulating as a shot of epinephrine, we'd love for you to show us some brand loyalty.
Yes, drop us a like and leave a review. It's the best prescription for podcast success.
Think of your review as the little booster shot that keeps our show in tip-top shape.
And hey, don't just keep us as your secret remedy. Share the good vibes and let others in on our Real Pharma therapeutic sessions.
So hit that review button like it's the perfect cure for a long commute. Your feedback is the treatment that keeps us going.
Thanks for tuning in. And remember, an episode a day keeps the boredom away.
Stay curious, stay healthy, and keep this podcast prescription handy for biopharma stories and insights.
See you next time.
Bye.